top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more. From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 289. They call it Murder Party. Indie horror from 2007. As we transition here into the fall season, it's nice to touch on, of all things, a Halloween-centered movie.
Halloween party, man. There's always a fun time to be had at a Halloween party.
Indeed. Last year, I went to an excellent Rue Morgue Halloween party in Toronto and dressed up with my girlfriend as Jack the Ripper and one of Jack the Ripper's prostitute victims from the Whitechapel neighborhood of London. And it was a lot of fun because we got her very, very bloody with like a slit neck. And we did the work. So taking the subway to this event was quite a trip because, yeah, we got a lot of, accolades and little kudos here as we braved public transit to get to our, not murder party, but Halloween party. So have you ever dressed up for Halloween? What do you usually do with the missus for Halloween?
Absolutely. A couple years in a row, I went as Bret Michaels. Got an awesome blonde wig with a bandana.
Now, was this a really accurate version of Bret Michaels, as in male pattern baldness afflicted Bret Michaels?
Or is it? Well, in the sense of the having a bandana covering the wig, yes. Yeah, basically. But yeah, it was loads of fun. In fact, we love Halloween. We love dressing up for Halloween. And for that actual party, it was held in a church. In Toronto here.
Oh, excellent.
And it was like a small church, 400 people at this party, DJ.
Just might have been the same affair.
Fantastic.
Just maybe
it was
in a
really
different
fantastic.
Year. So for our listeners, if you're not recognizing the voice coming out of the other side of the speaker, depending on how you're listening to this, this is Jonas, and he's a longtime friend of mine as Jeff is convalescing and recovering from medical issues. So Jonas has been kind enough to step in once again as we dive into Murder Party on the podcast. And
promise to have slightly less insightful and intelligent comments than Jeff usually does. Apologies in advance.
These are clown college shoes to fill here. I mean, I mean that in no disparaging
Songs
way.
Size 11.
These are massive Shaq O'Neal boots to fill because Jeff is very knowledgeable when it comes to horror. And
you know what they say about a man with big shoes? Big feet.
This is what many people say.
Right.
I heard. It's almost like in politics where if you're not the brightest bulb, you surround yourself with people who know more than you, and that's how I approach Jeff to do this podcast, because I'm more of a casual fan. He's got a mind of a trap to be able to recall instantly at the drop of a hat any sort of details of any.
It's remarkable.
It really is really remarkable. Yeah. I do my best here, but luckily for the purposes of this discussion, this is Murder Party, a rather small independent debut film from, I believe, a New York filmmaker that made considerable waves at the time, to the point where, I want to say this is 3 years ago, I was in a bar around Halloween, and it was the Bovine, a popular rock and roll like biker bar on Queen West here in Toronto, and there was a guy dressed up as the Sir Lancelot kind of...
Oh, no way! Brilliant.
More of the, I guess, Monty Python-esque knight that this character dresses up as, decked out in duct tape and fashion
cardboard.
Yeah and I thought, man, I went up to him and I introduced myself, said, hey man, that's just a great costume, it's phenomenal. The guy was like floored, probably for anyone to be able to recognize it.
Sure.
So I thought that was really, really badass, and
right.
It probably elicited befuddled looks and, you know, and wrinkled foreheads when the guy went out in Toronto dressed like this. But our protagonist of this film, and maybe he's Christopher. Maybe I should know this because that's my name. I can't recall. I've watched this several weeks ago. But the protagonist is sort of developed as, I believe, a typical functionary. With a kind of a dull, I want to say he was a parking attendant.
Okay.
So one of these pseudo police who goes around and tickets people.
But you're absolutely correct. He's like a meter maid.
Is that sexist? I don't know.
It is a dated term for sure. I presume it's probably.
It's pretty funny.
Like, I do apologize for.
Predominantly, the bulk.
Hope I didn't
of
trigger
these,
anyone there. But,
well, yeah.
You know, especially no parking attendants. You know, who might be listening? Who may or may not be female.
There's no disclaimers at this show, but I think 20, like 19 out of any 20 of these types of people I've seen have been men. It's kind of like delivery guys in a FedEx truck.
Yeah.
You never see a woman doing that. Rarely. There is a woman though who is. Become sort of infamous in Toronto, who's like, she's about 6 foot tall, and she's, you know, well, I'm going to use your term, a meter maid, and I've seen her on countless occasions just getting yelled at, and the abuse these people incur at the hands of high-strung motorists is beyond the pale.
They
say
dentists have the highest rate of suicide amongst all professions, but I mean, no one's happy to see the parking attendant, sorry.
In your fantasy, you would just back over them with your car if you could, but it's like they're doing an integral service.
Filling the coffers of the city council.
Exactly. A cheap way to make money. I often thought it was pretty bizarre when you have City of Toronto, like other cities, where you have like, the 1st of the month to the 14th of the month, you're allowed to park on the right, and then the 15th to the 30th
the other
on the
side. You have to be so vigilant in reading every sign you can find to, and this was, I lived in a few different places, San Francisco being one of them, and that was the biggest nightmare. You could read 12 signs, if you missed one, that indicated that now is not the time, boom, $180 ticket.
You need to like be able to suss out the subtleties of the Da Vinci Code when trying to figure out where to fucking park.
Right. And you shouldn't need an abacus walking around or a slide rule.
This is insane. So maybe you'd think, okay, he does this job. He's had his fill of interactions on a daily basis. So maybe that's how this kind of thing informs his home life. So we get a vision in the streets of Brooklyn of this guy, and he does this job. It's a thankless job. He goes home and to a very...
very simple domicile.
Yeah.
It's got a what do you call that kind of chair? It's a single chair in front of a
he's a single guy.
TV that you... Those the knobs, you know, from the
80s. Yeah, exactly. And a rabbit ears, maybe. And he's got a cat, which for a man of a certain
Sir
vintage...
Sir Lancelot, the name of the cat.
Oh, indeed. Yeah, yeah. Perfect. So it establishes him as this sort of recluse, wallflower-type guy who just wants...
presumably very few friends, very little social interaction in general outside of work.
And so you have this, like, very amazing streetscape in the streets of Brooklyn. And... this sort of POV camera shot of what is a very creepy scene on Halloween. So it follows him around, and it the camera sort of loops around, and you're wondering what's going on, whether this is a POV killer a la Halloween or Black Christmas. You don't know what's going on. But then you see an invite on the ground that the camera swoops into, and this is an invite to a murder party. And I was thinking of this movie called Demons, which is one of the first episodes Jeff and I podcast about this creepy guy on a Berlin subway platform who's handing out tickets to a party that's a launch of a film. And these two co-eds, these university types, see this creepy guy, and instead of running away, they accept tickets from him and go to this event, and things turn out not so
good for them.
No, not so swimmingly. So, caveat, you should maybe not go to random parties, but it's par for the course in a city landscape. You have constant...
sounds like a fun kind of activity to me.
I would go. Like,
absolutely. I wouldn't think twice.
Yeah, like
I'd be dumb enough to go to a murder party.
I would too. There's like, poles, street lamps and stuff in the downtown core that are fixed with posters advertising, let's say, raves, advertising all sorts of like cultural events, for lack of a better word, in the city.
Are there still posters advertising raves?
There might be, yeah. There's
it
still
very
like
99, 2002 to me.
It is, but that's an eye-catching medium, yeah. Because it's hard that you guarantee eyeballs. Like, who would have thought out-of-home advertising would still be a thing?
Sure.
But if you live in an intersection that's popular with condos and high-rises, billboard right there.
Try advertising for a party on one of the lampposts.
A murder party well. But you'd think, given that it's around Halloween, that such a party should not be taken literally.
Absolutely, yeah.
So the protagonist here sees that there's this invite, and I don't even remember the details. My God damn it.
I think it was just an address and a time. I think that was literally it.
Which is pretty enticing when you think about it. Because
and it was a nicely done up invite as well.
Yeah.
Looked attractive on good card stock. You know, it was black, had a funky
attractive
cutout.
Font.
You know?
Yeah, and so he decides.
Sans serif, maybe, I'm not sure.
So this guy decides to maybe, well, against his better judgment, and this is maybe around the time, maybe Brooklyn had gentrified to the point where it wouldn't be that big an issue, but he goes to this, again, off the beaten path warehouse district.
Making up a costume for himself, which I think we should discuss this costume, address it. Cardboard, put together hastily, just in the moment, kind of ridiculous, but at the same time, kind of quite creative and cheeky.
Yeah, you know? For something done on the spur of the moment, because he really had no time. It's something that maybe someone in fourth grade would have done as well, but it's funny in the context of an adult with glasses who's got a proper job. So maybe, it was terrific.
It looks like a kid's Halloween costume.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They made
and it's totally disarming.
Yeah.
It's totally charming. It's totally fun.
A cardboard knight is essentially what he is.
Good day, good sir knight.
Yes.
Yeah. Sayest thou good night unto me, sire? No, I sayest thou good night, knight. It was Monty Python-esque. It was fun. His cat is Sir Lancelot.
Right.
He's a fan of medieval
chivalry
history,
and all that jazz,
which is apparently dead, but you know, apparently wasn't during times.
It might be considered sexist now.
It might be, but during times when knights were jousting and were going to the Holy Land to reclaim it for Christendom,
right?
It was the cat's meow, man. You know, chivalry was very much alive,
right?
And so this guy goes to, I think, what is might be Red Hook or some part of Brooklyn that's maybe on the water, that's kind of dodgy. I think anywhere that's...
Meatpacking districts, perhaps? I'm not sure.
Manhattan, but
oh, is it? Okay.
This somewhere, anywhere along the waterfront that's a warehouse, it doesn't matter how gentrified...
What city you're in, either. It's going to be kind of dodgy.
Oh, even where you live now. I mean, if you keep walking east, there's going to be some of these, like... marinas and part where they some of the film business is in Toronto, like after dark there's really nothing that's going on there. There may be the stray hooker out there, but I don't even know if that's even even a thing.
I think it might be the area that hookers want to avoid just because of ease of dispatch, you know.
It's true. But there's something just seedy about waterfronts. That's why, like, you know,
That's why I love them.
So the likes of like Naples and Marseille,
Marseille's city. Crazy port city.
And like Naples is where I think Caravaggio was murdered or went missing or something. But there's always like seediness going on.
Right.
And so this guy goes to this warehouse and there's a door and he just goes in and...
Walks
right in. Unfortunately for him, this is a murder party. And this is where a group of art students have sequestered themselves and done this on a lark to attract someone to kill. And I mean, which is common enough because there's been, I want to say the Craigslist killer. There's been various, if I'm not mistaken, I'm not sure whether he was working in Los Angeles, but there's been like, let's say, dating app. There's been Tinder killers. There's been...
Right.
You know, grinder killers. So attracting someone to somewhere for nefarious purposes is unfortunately been a thing.
Well, there was a... And I'm not sure if you heard the story in Germany, and I believe this was a story, not a movie that I'm remembering.
No,
that was fictional.
If you want to say the cannibal.
It was a man who advertised, and he said, "I'm looking for another person. I want to eat you.
Schmeckt gut.
And echt, stimmt. You know, it's, an individual responded and said, yes, I'm interested in this. And this actually went down. You know, it's
and if I'm not mistaken, it went through the courts like a burrito goes through me on a Friday night. No, it was like, there was much discussion in jurisprudence about what to do with someone who willingly offers themselves up as a main course. And so this guy ate the other guy, and he didn't see anything wrong with it.
Yeah, and so it was consensual.
Yeah.
Wasn't sane or safe, but it was consensual.
And I think maybe to the extent they might have, it's going to be different there because in Canada, our legal system is based on British common law, where you have, I think I'm using the term right, an indignity to a body.
Okay.
They might have something different in the States, but he basically, if I'm not mistaken,
Germany, that might just be a Thursday evening.
It could be. He had to presumably dispose of part of this guy.
Sure. Unless, you can't eat it all. Right?
Maybe you can. Maybe if you have a big enough freezer.
Boil down the bones and make bone broth.
Yeah.
For the winter.
Stock.
Healthy.
Yeah.
No, right?
Indeed, yeah. Maybe a little salty.
Get some micronutrients in there.
Maybe it tastes like venison.
It could. No, maybe it tastes like chicken.
Just get Gordon Ramsay on the case to make a lovely hand-rolled tagliatelle pasta out of this thing. This is the star of the dish for MasterChef. It's gross. These art students in this abandoned warehouse have set up a scenario whereby they're going to dispatch this guy. Our protagonist, in a manner that's artistic. And I'm thinking of, I want to say, the Death of Marat, which is a famous painting depicting one of the victims of the French Revolution. Mm. It's a guy in a bathtub lying down, he's been killed. So the subject matter of someone's death, the crucifixion, it runs through hundreds of years of art. So, but they have differing visions on how to kill this poor guy in the knight's outfit.
And they do plan on documenting it either with a video camera or something like that, right?
Yes.
And therein lies the art. Because if something just happens, then it's performance art. But if it's documented, then it can live on. And that's certainly what they want.
Oh, yeah. And we should say that the different participants have a little bit of like internecine strife between them. Because I think they admit that one of their ranks is a better artist than the others. And maybe he doesn't show, but there's lots of discussion about surrounding which medium they should go with. One is, I think, a painter. Another one is, as you mentioned, let's say performative art. And the other would be documenting it as a piece of video installation art.
Right.
So they are discussing all these different means of dispatching this person. And I'm thinking, getting back to real life murder, there's Luca Magnotta, who's a Montreal-born killer of much like renown, who murdered he murdered an exchange student on the internet.
And
So this is the kind of thing. This is a similar, I think he lured him also on a dating site. And what made that case particularly creepy was he was, I think, a contestant on this low-grade Canadian reality show.
Right.
So Luca Magnotta, not his real name, but yeah, he murdered someone on the internet. And so these sociopaths and budding artists from the local art college are looking to turn this guy into their next masterpiece. And that's really the thrust of the narrative.
And part of their big reason for doing this is to secure the grant. Right?
Yeah.
The money which is, you know, every budding artist out there dream is to get some benefactor to pay him a bunch of money
to
do what they really want to do.
And if you're not the Medicis or somebody with like a Venetian or whatever.
Worked for Michelangelo, having a benefactor.
Yeah. Who can bankroll your life's work.
Your lifestyle, too.
Yeah. And it's pretty funny that this is like the MacGuffin for this movie that propels the plot, really.
Right.
Because, I mean, there has to be some sort of motivation beyond just making art, because it really, if art boils down to money, then you really gotta, I mean, it's a tough gig.
And there's the financing of it and the commercial aspect of selling the stuff, and then there's the creative, which, in a sense, I think it's almost like they're against each other, right?
Yeah.
It's like the commercial aspect, and then there's the pure art of it. You know?
Hey, it's something that I think Basquiat struggled with his whole life and couldn't come to terms with. So,
yeah.
I mean, speaking of a prominent New York artist, but it's just funny that
Picasso died poor and penniless, didn't he?
Van Gogh did.
He didn't. Okay. Well, many artists obviously did.
His brother posthumously, Theo, unloaded a bunch of his works for incredible sums.
Right.
So he was like the cautionary tale of the artist living in these cramped quarters and not surviving at all. So it's pretty funny that this is all about that and they're bickering, the six or seven different artists here, as to what they could do, because it's by no means settled, which is kind of funny. You think if you're going to go through
before
all this trouble,
we're going to set up the murder that we commit.
Yeah.
And invite a fool over. You'd think you'd plan it out. You're right.
But maybe they figured, and this is maybe not delved into too much, they maybe figured no one would be a big enough loser to even consider that as an option on Halloween, or they figured that many more than one would show up and would have their pick of the litter as different types of murders you could be able to pull out.
They do kind of indicate that they're like, oh, I can't believe anyone was stupid enough to show up for a murder party. But at the same time, they totally expected someone to show up because they're all sitting there ready and waiting. This is the whole event of Plan of the Evil.
Yes. You know? And I believe one of them is dressed up as one of the gang members from the Warriors.
Absolutely.
The chick, I think she's just some sort of 80s new wave punk rocker.
No, she is.
Or is she a...
She is from Blade Runner. The replicant,
Daryl
Hannah's character.
Holy shit!
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I was just going to go with
where she first shows
like,
up, you know, and she's dressed up in the makeup.
Okay, I was just figuring some St. Mark's Place like new wave punk scene kind of thing.
Yeah. Some New Order reference you didn't get, or something.
Yeah, but that makes it even better.
Yeah,
this is taking you into a territory where you think you know where you're going, because this is 2007. This is in the height of the torture porn Saw hostel boom.
Right.
So when you
Good
get
point.
A guy who's tied, been tied to a chair, like, you know, I'm thinking of the Johnny Cash song Delia, you know, where the victim's tied to a chair and then murdered in Memphis. They tie him to a chair and he's captive and they're interrogating him and mocking him and doing all this stuff. And you're just thinking, okay, this is going to be this protracted, like, disgusting, pointless exercise in torture porn.
Gruesome gore.
But this is not the tone that's set up. This is funny. This is kind of very...
Dark black comedy elements.
It is, yeah. And they joke about, like, putting him in...
First method of dispatch is to dump a jug of acid on it.
Yes.
They're like, oh, it's going to be terrible.
This is going to be incredible. And then,
they smell it. They're like,
they smell it.
It's
and
acetic
it's not,
acid.
It's acetic acid,
which is
vinegar. And then one of them, like, chimes in, like, we can't pick, what are we doing? Pickling the guy?
Yeah. Pickling
so
him to death?
It's very funny. And he, like, recoils in horror that he's going to have, you know, acid, you know, thrown in his visage.
Yeah.
And man, and that threw me for a loop too, because I didn't know where this was going when I first saw it several years ago. I revisited it since to see how it would hold up. And I was thinking, like, man, this is amazingly fun. And the dialogue is informed by a repeated use of the word dildo. And these guys call one another dildo.
Right.
And I don't know why. It seemed like an affectation among friends, maybe. And these
I
people.
Think so. It makes sense, yeah.
And it was very, very funny how the banter between them. One of them is hungry, goes out to, like, grab a sub.
Pizza or something.
Yeah, and they have this protracted discourse about what they want for food. And it's almost like a Pulp Fiction-esque, like, diner discussion between the two principals about Royale with cheese. Like, it's this commonplace activity fulfilling, you know, the, Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Right.
Where you're just like, oh, I need to eat before I kill. And they're just like, oh, I don't feel like Thai. I had it yesterday. I don't feel like Mexican. It was like... pretty weird. It was funny and odd and tonally different from what I expected.
Right.
So when things start to come to a head, it gets pretty interesting because, again, they can't decide. One of the members of their ranks is, I don't even know. I was going to ask you whether he was an actual Slavic gangster or whether that was a costume. It was kind of ambiguous.
No. Okay. So I believe that guy... was, and I'm not talking about the actor, But, you know, that character was meant to be a Slavic drug dealer.
Not a costume.
Absolutely. And I think it kind of, the narrative makes sense if you think of it that way as well, because, you know, he does a couple murders himself there and doesn't seem to have any issues doing it. He's got a real gun. You know, he provides the drugs as well.
Serum to, as part of this group's
extreme truth game. or something like that.
And this stuff, this was tested by KGB. And it was used on Chechen rebels in KGB. Like this kind of shit, right?
Yeah.
Sodium pentothal. Sodium pentothal. It was tested on Chechen. I do a pretty good Muscovite accent.
It's not bad, right? There you go.
And so they inject one another with this truth serum, and the one guy's a bit skittish about the needle, but that was like a pivotal point in the movie, and they start battling one another, and that's when one of the captors dies and sends this whole narrative into a different spin that takes it into a complete different direction.
Just kind of funny. So before our protagonist arrives at the party, he takes his jack-o'-lantern, or old jack-o'-lantern pumpkin from the stoop, which I thought was kind of funny because did you have this jack-o'-lantern sitting there for 3 weeks before Halloween?
It's already wilted, it's already sunken.
So he goes and he makes pumpkin bread.
Yeah.
Out of this, brings it to this murder party,
which is very funny, like incredibly naive.
Absolutely.
Like, for someone in the Big Apple to behave like this,
very, very socially kind of, I don't want to say inept, but kind of missing the mark. In terms of, you know...
yeah, because like, presumably, if this was a murder party, there would be hundreds of people. So, it's at a warehouse. So, to whom would you give this?
Right.
Like, is this where you're going to set it on the DJ booth?
Give it to the security guy? Like, if it's that big? You don't really know what you're walking into, right?
Unless he didn't know it was a warehouse. But you think, like, he didn't... I don't know if he Google mapped the location, but it's just like...
Yeah, I think he printed out, like, a MapQuest kind of deal. Remember that, you know? Yeah, and so he brings it and hands him to like whatever, but the one girl eats it and then she realizes there's raisins. She says, "Are these organic raisins?"
He's like, yeah, exactly.
I don't think so. And she's like, "I'm allergic to raisins if they're not organic." And then she kind of passes out, bashes her skull in a piece of metal.
That's the pivotal point.
Now, before Antoine, who's coming over, and this is this character that is this guy that everyone's kind of like, ooh, spooky about. He's the guy who's got the grant money and
ringleader.
We got to impress this guy. And okay, and so he's like kind of the honcho, you know. And so they hide her body in the deep freeze because they don't want him to know that someone's already dead before the cameras
got
rolled.
This is great stuff. That just like propelled things too. And it's like... It's funny. I'm glad you're here on the discussion because you are the one who inspired me to go out solo on adventures because you are a very much more gregarious fellow than I am.
Right.
And you have no bones about going out and doing something. You would go out on a Tuesday and just go to a bar and see what adventure you could find.
Absolutely.
And I took that to heart on several occasions too.
Yeah.
And I've gone out on my own and just met people and gone out in some like weird misadventures. And as it turns out, you know, I can't get into detail.
Right.
But it's pretty interesting to the extent that I don't even...
You usually get a good story out of it. You know?
I wouldn't go to like some derelict part of town to do this on my own.
Right.
I would enlist one other buddy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Hey, Chris, you want this thing? Yeah, sure. All right, we'll go together. Yeah, bye.
There's an after-hours club in Toronto that I used to frequent, and I would be afraid to go there. As I hear it's either mobbed up or with it's biker affiliated, so I would be afraid to go there with one friend.
Right.
Because, you know, it opened to three. It's if it got robbed, you'd be there.
Safety
and you can't
numbers.
Call the cops.
Yeah.
You're fucked. So I was afraid of that place, and a friend of mine used to go by himself, and I was like, just... mystified that he would do that because this place has like, you know, it's a gambling den. It like there's coke all over the place. It was like it was a scary place.
Very sketchy.
There's people there you wouldn't associate with under any circumstances.
Larry Miller would say people who got out of jail just as recently as this
morning.
This morning,
I know that bit.
Brilliant.
That's
bit.
An excellent. Yeah.
So Larry Miller, seven excellent, levels of drinking or comment. Five stages of drinking, Google it, YouTube it, you'll be happy. Anyways, that, moving
on. That's great stuff. And the two of us, like when we were really young, went to New York in the 90s to hang out in the East Village. That 10 was
days.
A trip.
We went. We were supposed to be there for like 2-3 days. We ended up staying for 10 days.
Oh, yeah. We connected with these Russians in Brooklyn, near Coney Island. Right. We hung out with them and just drank with these Russians. It extended our stay much further than anticipated.
Absolutely.
And hung out in this crappy neighborhood, which now has since been gentrified, called Alphabet City.
Right.
So it's just interesting to see, as New York is depicted on screen, infamously in the likes of Maniac or Driller Killer in the horror pantheon.
Yeah, that New York of the 80s, kind of early 90s, like that, I don't think that exists anymore.
Yeah,
it's
done. No,
it's all Starbucks and Nike stores. And
yeah, and no peep shows, none of that happening. But this is a place that it's like, even though there's only 10 minutes of the Big Apple, that 10 minutes is pretty fucking scary. And the fact that this is an internally contained movie in a warehouse, they made the best of that. And to the extent to which they could have done more, I would have liked to see more of that.
Right.
So, but I think as a contained exercise in horror, I think that was incredibly well done.
They funded it all with their own money too.
Yeah.
They didn't get any funding for it, and then they all had to.
Grants.
Right. Exactly.
You could have crowdsourced this.
Was crowdsourcing a thing back?
It might not have been. I think maybe so. In the 2011 it would have like come to the fore.
Yeah.
2010 maybe.
So they all had to wear multiple hats. So they were acting, and then they were also producing and doing everything. And great job.
Really great. And this
kind of a bad movie, but kind of like really entertaining at the same time.
Oh, given the strictures and the constraints of indie horror, of which this is, I mean, let's say they spent $300K on it, which is not unreasonable. Maybe even 100, like, let's say.
I think it'd be interesting to know.
I would love to know. I don't know what the guys have done since, but I thought this was a splendid fucking
affair. They've done some fantastic stuff. They did Blue Ruin. Have you seen this film?
No.
Oh, fantastic, kind of violent, weird movie. Amazing. And then they also did Green Room with Patrick Stewart.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm embarrassed to admit, Jeff and I podcasted that.
Okay.
And, I mean, yeah, menacing neo-Nazi sort of, gangster guys with Patrick Stewart in a phenomenal role.
Totally against type. I loved it.
Amazing. Yeah. If we segue into what we've learned here, I was going to say there's a reference to Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven, and one of the characters quotes at length this bit. And
he does,
I was like, what? How do I know that?
Right.
Where do I know that from? And it's maybe the
Raven gently tapping and tap, tap, tapping.
And it was like, maybe is he the Bard of Baltimore? I don't know what his nickname is, but Edgar Allan Poe is like, holy shit, what a great reference. And I thought, man, this is just a smart, self-contained, self-aware, funny. Took me in a direction I didn't anticipate.
Yeah.
So it's a short thing of what I learned, but like, I invite you to chime in as to what you might have learned. Yeah.
I learned that there are people out there who have the same impressions of the student art scene as that I had. When I went to Western, I did a lot of third and fourth year kind of visual arts courses, whatever, because it kind of tied into my other major. And I went to a lot of art gallery openings, or art show openings rather, drank all the free booze I could find at the time when I was going to these things, had a blast, but it was very weird. I had a video artist who was a prof who like I had zero respect for, so I really enjoyed the kind of the critique and this kind of cheeky self-awareness of this
bursting the bubble of that scene.
I'm
gonna mess this up, but it might be Annie Hall. There's a scene where Woody Allen is in this art gallery, and one of the would-be aesthetes is waxing poetic about,
it was in the line from the movie.
They're like, oh, I love this guy's use of negative space.
Oh,
like Woody Allen is like rolling his eyes going like, I don't know what the fuck this is, and it's just like, I'm at once enamored by and repulsed by this kind of world, because at its best you have transcendent, remarkable stuff,
and
your Jasper Johns or your like amazing incredible artists, modern artists, and then at its worst you have stuff that needs to be explained away in a title, or right. else you would not be able to make head nor hair of anything.
Sure.
And your inability to engage with it creates this divide between artist and viewer that can't be overcome. And you're like, okay, I have to be explained as to, you know, what this is. Like, there's this Dutch artist named Piet Mondrian, and he's famous for making these squares.
Right.
And he has these, like, bichromatic squares, and they're like squares. And damned if I know what the fuck that is. You know, but before him, no one decided to make squares on a canvas subject matter because it was unique and revolutionary for the time.
Right.
So I'm always like, I feel like I'm out of my depth when I'm engaging with art, especially installation art and especially video art, where I'm absolutely. Like, I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah. I did a piece of installation art, actually, when I was at Western.
You're
shitting me. I'm serious.
Okay. What was the subject matter?
So it was kind of political activism in a sense. I went at like 4 a.m. Western's got this space called Concrete Beach, and it's just this like open pavilion. So on the ground.
Of the campus, right on the campus.
Yeah, on the ground, probably, I want to say 30 feet by like maybe 40 feet. I kind of mapped out in chalk, and then I painted Nike with a swoosh dripping in blood and underneath the words, "Know What You Wear." Because this was around the time when it was coming out where they had, you know, people chained to workstations in Indonesia and stuff making their shoes. So like I said, I really appreciated a lot of the elements of this film.
Look
because
at this.
Of like
rabble rousing activism here on, stuff, and defacing the property of Western University.
Right. I mean, it was washable paint, so it wasn't, you know, it wasn't an evil thing. A couple of rainfalls, it would have gone or whatever.
Oh my God. But, and campus security wasn't there to like.
And this video artist, who was my prof for that course, this is why I was so. This is one of the reasons why I had zero respect for this guy. And apparently, Steve Ramey was his name. I shouldn't have mentioned his name. It doesn't matter. He was quite a respected video artist, which is why I got the post, right? He wouldn't even make the trip from the visual arts building to go look at it. He's like, yeah, take some pictures of it, will you? And just give it to me. And then I'll mark you based on that. I'm like, are you serious?
Wow.
Anyways.
I was thinking Nuit Blanche's All Night Art Festival. I don't know which cities have it, but it's several cities. So it's installations run all night in Toronto. It gets really rolling at around 1 a.m, and you can watch all these things take place throughout the city. It's a big to-do. And thousands, millions of people show
up. They extend the drinking hours, which is a huge thing in Toronto, or Canada,
and, I remember on Queen Street West here in the de facto art street of the city where a lot of the galleries are, there was this installation where they had this person in a glass box who was sleeping.
Huh.
And he was sleeping complete with a comforter, complete with a pillow, and was just snoring there in this box. And there was if I'm not mistaken, there was a velvet rope around it saying, like, do not disturb. And they had a thing going.
Be quiet, person
yeah,
sleeping.
So people wouldn't knock on it or anything. So there was a person sleeping, and the whole idea of it was to take something that no one is privy to unless it's personal with your significant other, and making it really extremely public. In a way that I found, like, I didn't know what the point of this was particularly.
Sure.
But I walked up to the person, and it's kind of unnerving to watch someone just sleep as a spectator. It was fucking weird. And, like, it's one thing if you see a homeless person, they're crashed out, you expect someone to sleep on the street. You don't expect someone to have the accoutrements of sleep time and be, like, comfortably napping in an elevated bed. It was like, who would? I had so many questions.
How many sleeping pills did they take beforehand?
It was weird. They were up like 5 feet off the ground in a glass box, and they're like, here's a person sleeping, and like, I don't know why that sat with me, and I don't know what, like, it doesn't really, it's at once arresting and at once meaningless. So it has
banal.
No. It is jejune.
It's arrestingly banal.
It is banal jejune and whatever it is. I don't know, but it sat with me. So it stuck with me to the point where I would say once the rain washed away your little bit of death to Nike, then it would have, you know, this would have been a little more something. But again, that's the type of thing that would have required maybe a lengthy explanation about how we were subverting cultural norms as it pertains to the subconscious or some bullshit. Like, it would have had a plaque of bullshit.
Right.
So the fact that these guys were poking fun at some of their probably colleagues as they were in art school.
Sure, I presume, right?
And it's pretty great to see that in the context of a film like this.
Couple brilliant comedic moments I remember from this film, and I'm not going to spoil anything, but there is a scene where someone is chasing someone else with an electric chainsaw carrying the cord behind them, which is not plugged in.
Yeah, oh, exactly.
Which, of course, once you get to your location, you need to find a plug and resume attacking. And that itself is just hilarious. I thought it was brilliant.
Oh, I love that. And it's great because Jeff and I podcasted Touch of Death, which is a Lucio Fulci movie where this guy is like feeding a corpse to his pigs and he cuts it up with a chainsaw. And that's the first scene before the credits roll. And it made me laugh because it's like, once you've written this, like, how can you cash a check later or whatever the analogy is? Like, this is, where do you go from here after you do that? And Tobe Hooper's Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is the first bona fide horror movie I ever saw.
Brilliant
when I was
too.
Like 13.
Brilliant for what it doesn't show.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Brilliant for its use of negative space, if you will.
Hey, there you go.
But I thought, like, man, that made me laugh. That was just great. So it's playing with convention and doing so in a way that was just very, like, this is as charming as any horror film I've seen since maybe Motel Hell or it has so much like lovability to it.
It really does. It's kind of sweet and endearing.
It is. You know? It is indeed.
For a movie with a lot of deaths in it and quite a gory finale, it's kind of sweet and endearing.
I think considering we enlisted you first off for Most Likely to Die, I think
we've
really upped the ante in terms of the quality of the films.
Absolutely. I appreciate that.
Because we brought you in to just basically rip that one a new arsehole, which was like maybe one of the worst modern horrors, I think, ever.
I still submit that Cam is up there in terms of a horrible, horrible...
Hey, you got to...
Maybe I'm alone in my derision of this
film. I kind
of
liked the way it used new media as an interface.
Okay.
I thought it was kind of fun. It was bad.
Right. Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, but that is a genre that's bad.
Right.
So, I mean, if you're... I mean, working there, there's lots of just crap that you're dealing with, and that is not even near the worst.
Right.
I'm thinking like maybe Unfriended or that kind of thing.
Okay.
There's one that's like a Skype kind of interface. I could be getting it wrong. There's another one called iCam Killer or something like that. Yeah, these are bad. It's like maybe the worst subgenre of horror, but Cam, that was pretty bad. But I got a kick out of some of the like the lurid like sex work kind of elements of it. I thought that
was entertaining. But I think what upset me about that was that
the
accolades that I read about.
Oh, agreed. Agreed.
It's brilliant. And
yeah.
I'm like, okay, whatever. You know?
No, when you compare it to Videodrome or another movie that more efficaciously deals with changing technologies, man, it's night and day. But it's one of the better social media horrors I've seen, which is, again, the bar is so low.
Right.
Like, it is fucking terrible. Like, but I would give that maybe three out of five.
Okay.
I enjoyed how they just went for the gusto. I enjoyed the fact that one was a cam girl and she kept this, secret. And when her family finds out, it was quite a pivotal, interesting scene.
That's
particularly
true.
Her brother.
There's some interesting moments.
There are some interesting moments, but yeah.
I feel like I've led us astray from the murder party topic here.
No, but this movie was a party. If not in your mouth, for your eyes, then I'm going to give this a solid 3.5. Because I think it's a bit like, I don't know if you've seen Terrifier, but that's a movie with a killer clown that has since grown in estimation. Like, we're always looking.
As you were. I want to see it, though.
You have to see it because, like, it's very polarizing, but it's extremely violent. It's a throwback to that kind of grindhouse movie from the 80s. It's dark, it's violent, it's gross. It reminds me of Driller Killer and Maniac. I love that shit. It's fun as an old someone who's, didn't come of age in the 80s, someone who was like really young at the time. I like seeing movies that become cult hits now.
Sure.
And it's interesting because I don't have to see them through nostalgia. I see them through the eyes of an adult.
Right.
And then as they grow in people's estimation, and Murder Party is one such film. To the extent that it references Warriors, and there's a guy, Warriors is a movie that has spawned many people dressing up for Halloween.
It's got
to
the
tie
baseball
up the
outfit, in case you want. It's kind of a New York Yankees kind
of
deal.
Yeah, it's a baseball fury.
Painted face.
I've wanted to go out as that character.
Yeah,
for Halloween. I just haven't done it. One of these days I'll do it. But to see a Murder Party guy dressed up in a bar. It's like, man, this is great. It's the cultural impact. It's not going to be, you know, or maybe it will be. It won't be the same as maybe your Chucky or that kind of thing.
I think it came out to not much fanfare, but I think it kind of grew in its steam and everything else, like as some years progressed. You know,
as well it should. I mean, you know, a few quibbles. Maybe they could have invested a little more in the guy, but
was older. In the
protagonist, just because he's like, okay, he has a cat, he's a loser. Like,
I felt bad.
I don't
want to
cast aspersions because I've had a cat myself, but like as a man with the like
single man
with living alone with a cat is kind of like it's.
This is a lot to work with there.
It's Tinder kryptonite. Let's be honest, right? Like it's not good, right?
Right, right.
So, but as things, I'm gonna give this a solid. Solid 3.5.
3.5.
Like,
nice.
I really fucking enjoyed this thing, and it—I think it improved with the viewing since I caught it like several years ago, and I just wanted to revisit it. So I texted Jeff to say, "Hey, like maybe this one." And
nice.
So yeah, I'm glad to have you sub in for him. Your star
fantastic.
Rating.
You know, I think do you guys do like, you guys don't really do decimals. You do like half or like none. Like you don't
like
do like a 2.8 or something.
Round,
you know,
round
like
it up.
2.84. You know. Yeah.
Pi, an excellent film, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic. Aronofsky.
I took a woman out in university
right?
on our first date to
ooh.
See Pi.
Oh, that's
and
bold
she
move.
Thought that, you know, I,
nice.
You know, she was a little, you know, reticent, but, you know,
right.
I knew she was on my wavelength when we took that one on. So
he wrote on the music for that, too, right?
Yeah?
He wrote on the music for that, Aronofsky.
Whoa, a talented fellow.
Tell me about
holy
it.
Holy crap. Okay, so you're going to give this
2.8.
2.8 out of 5?
Yeah.
What? Why so...
It was cheeky. It was fun. Well, you know, upon your challenge, the fact that I have trouble justifying my 2.8...
yeah, exactly.
Well, I'll let it land in on a solid 3.
Yeah, I mean, it has its pacing moments. There's a couple instances where, you know, obviously they have to get away, and then toward the end when there's not to spoil the denouement, but it does drag on for the last 10-15 minutes where the final... Grand Guignol, you know, pièce de résistance that's revealed maybe isn't as grand as budding artists maybe would have liked to have conceived it as.
Right.
I think maybe, but that's a slight debit. Hopefully you don't find any such, you know, nitpicking, you know, elements to our podcast and you continue to enjoy it every Friday for your listening pleasure uploaded. And we will have Jeff back to his full self and, you know, the picture of health, of good health. And he'll be joining us as we continue to discuss horror films predominantly, but genre films of all stripes on the Really Awful Movies podcast. And we'll talk to you soon.
It's been a blast. Thanks for having me on. And I hope to be back here invited again at one point.
Or as Jeff's catchphrase is, take care.
As Jeff would say, take care.